Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of March. Healthcare on the agenda, the first hour of today's program. On Thursday, March 5, President Barack Obama had a summit, as you'll recall. Congressional leaders, community leaders, major stakeholders, very concerned citizens who have been affected by the healthcare system gathered in Washington, D.C. to talk about healthcare reform, which certainly has been an issue we've talked about for years and years now on this program. Will there be significant health care reform, and what form does it need to take is the question of this hour. We'll have three guests with us. A very interesting story from Jim Stopher and Jan Stopher. They are with Holy Cow Frozen Custard in Delafield and have a remarkable story to tell about job layoffs, about starting a business in Delafield that became wildly successful, but trying to maneuver a healthcare system to cover their family of five children and to cover themselves. Jim attended the White House conference on March 5. He'll talk about his experiences there. Debbie Sokolar will join us a little bit later this hour, project manager of health policy and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. She was particularly involved in Massachusetts' health care reform program, so we will be speaking with her and, of course, welcoming your phone call. As this new administration takes on health care reform, what are the issues that are confronting you as individuals, as families, as people who are working and maybe underinsured, or you feel like you have terrific insurance? How do we handle the huge number of people in this country who have no insurance whatsoever? We'll be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do, in our number 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you'd like, and that is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Jim Stopher and Janet Stopher are joining us in our studios here in Milwaukee. They started this business that I simply will have to go to as soon as summer hits, Holy Cow Frozen Custard. They moved here from Ohio. Jim has worked in the engineering field and has suffered layoffs from many positions. They followed their dream and started this business, but they've had horrendous problems securing health care for themselves and also for their five children. Jim will tell the story in just a moment here of getting invited to this White House conference and what he presented to the president and what he heard when he was there. And Jan will also be talking about how they maneuver the healthcare system. She's manager of leadership development services in the Institute of Management at Management Resource Association, which is based in Waukesha. Jim has also worked as a teacher and in other professions as well, but it sounds from reading about them that their love is Holy Cow Frozen Custard, and I can see why. And we already have a number of you calling in. Hold on, we'll get to you in just a moment. Jan and Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Nice to have you here. Well, let's start with the big news, because it certainly must have been an event of a lifetime, and that's to meet with the president and congressional leaders about health care reform. How did you get there, Jim?
Well, back in, I guess, during the transition team, President Obama put something on the Obama.com website that said, if you are interested in helping us reform the health care, volunteer, sign up to be have a community meeting where people all over the country could host these groups of concerned citizens and discuss the ideas of what needs to change, what has to be changed. And one of those meetings was scheduled for Oconomowoc just the day after Christmas. Friends of ours, the Tanners, we were planning to go, and then the weather intervened in a negative way. We had a lot of snow that night, and the meeting got canceled. And I talked to our friend Dina and said, I really want to have this input into this system, because we've suffered with this healthcare system. And so she forwarded a letter. She asked me to just write your story, and we'll send it in instead of the report. And so that's what I did. And what I ended up with was about a 2.5-page letter just describing what we've gone through and some of the limitations of the coverage that we have. And that letter made it to the Department of Health and Human Services. It bounced around in Washington for who knows how long. I got a call back in January with some follow-up questions. And then Monday, a week ago, I just got a call out of the blue, said, can you be on a plane to Washington Wednesday?
Yeah, we get those calls all the time.
So at first, quite honestly, Jan and I were a little skeptical because, you know, for security reasons, they need our social security number. They actually wanted my bank account numbers and
really?
Everything else because the
for expenses.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
They've gone paperless at the White House, and the only way to get reimbursed is they direct deposit. So they sent us all these forms, and I was supposed to fax them in, and it's like, how do I know that someone in Nigeria isn't doing this, you know?
Right.
We were a little skeptical there, but we looked up the contact people from the Department of Health and Human Services, and as it turned out, they did show up on the website. So I got confidence, but I still we opened a new checking account just in case. So anyway, as it turned out, I got to the airport, and there actually was a plane ticket waiting for me there. So I figured this has to be real. So I got on the plane and ended up in Washington, D.C. at the J.W. Marriott Hotel on Wednesday afternoon. Then on Thursday morning, got to meet our host in the lobby there with six other individuals that had been invited at the same time from these various groups around the country. And we walked together with the camera crew over to the White House, had some photo op in front of the White House, and then were escorted in the southeast entrance. From there, we went into the White House, and it was an experience of a lifetime. The building itself would be a national historic site. It is. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just beautiful. We went upstairs to the east wing, I believe it was, where the room was set up for 120 people. We were seated, the seven of us were seated on the front row right in front of President Obama. We were acknowledged during the introduction, and then we got the best seat in the house, basically, to watch President Obama's opening remarks. He spoke, it's the same, I can't really summarize everything he said, but basically it's time for change. We need to do something, and to take no action is not an option this time. We're going to change. Now, he didn't come out and say, this is what we're going to do. And I think that was the problem that the Clinton administration had back in the 90s is they came up with the solution and presented it. And if it was rejected, well, President Obama is very intelligent. And I think what he's doing is saying, we all agree there's a problem. I'm not going to be the one to say how to fix it. You guys are. And so he brought together these people from industry, people from the health insurance industry, people from the hospitals and from doctors' organizations and from nursing associations and different special interest groups, businesses all over, and plus the seven of us concerned citizens, and said, okay, we're all here. We're going to break out now. We're going to go into smaller groups where there's going to be some discussion. And we're going to hammer this out. And in the end, this will be the first step toward ultimate change. And he was very affirmative that there will be change. And that gave me hope. So we went into these breakout sessions. It was actually a table discussion moderated by Melody Barnes. And she went around the table to these were mainly the dignitaries that were able to speak. I was seated back by the C-SPAN cameras, but I got to witness the whole thing. Each person at the table was able to speak for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes to describe what they were feeling about the issue and how they saw need for change. And I was astounded that I did not see a lot of bickering going
really?
On.
Good.
It was everybody was on target with the president in terms of, okay, we are going to make a change this time. And I think the only protectionism I saw was from one of the CEOs who was trying to make the argument that we need to continue with the the employer-based healthcare plan because that's how I attract and keep good employees. And of course, under my breath, I'm saying, well, why don't you just pay them more? You know, let everybody have healthcare. Don't hold that carrot out that's elusive, you know.
And you had a chance to give your letter again to President Obama, who put it in his pocket.
Let me tell that part of the story briefly. I know we're running time, but at the end of the meeting, everybody came back from these breakout sessions and they had rearranged the East wing to put President Obama on a podium in the middle of the room. And this time, the seven of us were seated right behind him instead of right in front of him. And he summarized just the highlights that were handed to him 45 minutes earlier of each breakout session. He introduced Ted Kennedy, and it was just a resounding applause, a very warm feeling. Everybody in the room was backing him. And then he mentioned during his closing remarks that he gets hundreds of letters every day with people telling stories of healthcare issues and how it affects their lives. And he says his staff personally selects 10 letters that he would read each day. So as he's leaving the room, you know, we got a chance to shake his hand, and I said to him, I handed him this letter, the same one that had got me to Washington in the first place, and I said, would you mind reading just one more letter? And he smiled and tucked it in his suit coat.
Great. So. Tell us the story of how your encounters with the healthcare system. You've worked on this issue and tried to secure healthcare for your family for a long time. You may want to start with where Jim started, with Ohio, when he came to Wisconsin for a job, and you stayed in Ohio, and the story begins with health insurance, Jan.
Oh, well, I think one of our first shocks about health insurance and acquiring it and keeping it was, even before that, we have a son who was born with a congenital heart condition, and when he was about 2 years old, needed open heart surgery, which obviously very traumatic. Luckily, Jim's employed. We have great coverage, so that part sounds very good. He had the surgery. Luckily, everything went well. Shortly after that, his human resource director calls him into an office and kind of chewed him out, because as a result of our son's surgery, their premiums at the company went up severely. And just coincidentally, the next day, he was laid off.
Oh, my gosh.
He came walking in the door. Oh, it was terrible. He came walking in the door on a Friday afternoon, just in a state of shock, and said, I've lost my job. Because, and this wasn't the official reason they gave, but we knew it was because their health premiums had gone up because of our son's care. That was the first step. We then went through a couple of layoffs with other jobs that Jim had. He came here. We started up Holy Cow, and what we discovered was it's very difficult to get good health insurance that really covers anything. We are not looking for a handout by any means, and I think there are a lot of people that would agree with us. We pay for an individual policy, I'm sure, as much as anybody else is paying with both their own individual coverage and their employer's contribution. We pay a significant amount of money every year for health care coverage, and we come under a category that actually was mentioned at the White House summit, and it's called insured but with no access to health care.
Right.
And that's us. We're insured, but we have no access to health care. Luckily, when our children were young, we had the group coverage through an employer. But now, we have such high deductibles. First of all, we pay a lot of money every year. Jim alone has a $7,500 deductible.
Ooh.
So with a $7,500, and we're paying as much as anyone else is paying. With that, it really means that anything we need to have done, we're paying out of pocket. And we pay several thousand dollars a year on top of that for just routine medical care that we need, but it's all coming out of pocket. In addition, and Jim, I think I'm going to throw this over to you, and perhaps you can tell about some of the trials of keeping a policy once you have it. They don't want you to keep the policy. The insurance companies have a vested interest in jumping you from plan to plan to plan. And Jim, why don't you tell a little bit about that?
Well, back in 2001, when we started to hit this individual healthcare market head on, because I couldn't keep a job that would give me health benefits through a group employer group, because I was spending so much time running our business during the summer that I just couldn't take that much time off and qualify for the benefits. So I started looking around, and what I found is it's so confusing. There was just there was no way to understand or comprehend anything. And we even I bought what was called an indemnity plan, thinking it was health insurance. It was billed as health insurance, but I later decided I'm going to understand this stuff. So I went in and I took the courses to become a licensed health insurance agent in the state of Wisconsin. I took the exams. I passed the exams. I actually got listed by a company. I sold two policies. And after I sold those two policies, I said, you know, in good conscience, I can't sell this stuff. This is terrible. So I dropped out. But I learned a lot from taking those classes. And one of the things I learned that applies, I'll summarize it. There's three types of health insurance in this state. You've got group health insurance that you get through an employer. You've got individual policies that if you aren't covered under group, you can purchase if you qualify through underwriting. And then, of course, there's the state plan, the HRSP or Badger Care, that everybody else falls into if they can't get on one of those, supposedly. And, of course, the fourth option is just don't have any insurance. So anyway, what happens with the individual market, which is our pet peeve, we don't have what's called guaranteed issue coverage. That means if I work for employer A as a group health employee, if I'm under a group plan and I work for employer A and I am dissatisfied for any reason, I can go to employer B, seamlessly take my letter of creditable coverage and just walk over to the new company and get right on their health plan. As a individual policy holder, if I'm dissatisfied with my insurer, I can't just go over to another insurer and say, I want to go with you, because I have to go through underwriting to get there. And then anything that may have happened under insurer A gets excluded by insurer B. And so one of the things that the insurance companies have, there's a law that's written into the state that says it's called the 2-year contestability clause. After you've had an individual policy for 2 years, the state says you can't deny claims because of pre-existing conditions, errors made on the application. Basically, you have to start paying. Before that, they can deny claims. Yeah. Well,
and prior to that, they actively look for ways to deny claims. They have all of these exclusions and loopholes and ways. For example, during that 2-year time, if you are diagnosed with cancer that you didn't know you had, but if a doctor says that that tumor's been growing for, let's say, 3 years, now you didn't know you had that, they can deny that. So, Jim, go ahead.
So anyway, because of the 2-year contestability clause, elimination and probationary periods for the first 6 or 12 months of a policy, the insurance company really doesn't take a lot of risk with you for those first 2 years, and because they can deny. But after 2 years, all of a sudden your policy becomes risky to them. So they want to get you out. Now, by law, they can't just say, well, we're not going to cover you anymore. But what they can do is raise your premium. Mm-hmm. And what they do, it's funny because you get this letter and it says, due to the rising cost of healthcare. Mm-hmm. Well, it has nothing to do with that. What it really is we're going to raise your rates 28% each year until you can't afford it anymore. And then it'll force you to go back out, and then you go back through underwriting. You get a clean bill of health and maybe somebody else will insure you. But
And just as an example of the kinds of things that can keep you from getting insurance, we have different policies. As a matter of fact, in our family right now, we're covered by 3 different individual policies because my company denied Jim, his company denied me. Our daughter's on a university policy, and the last time I was denied, it was because my iron in my blood was a little low. Now, I suspect it actually was for some other reason, but that's the official reason that they gave. So they really can deny you for almost anything.
There are times you have a history of cancer in your family, don't you?
Yeah.
You need preventive care and you should have some screenings, but you're not getting it.
I've never had cancer.
Right.
I've got 3 brothers that had cancer. It's funny because I went in to become a stem cell donor for one of my brothers, and my doctor wrote in my medical record that I was in because my brother had cancer. Well, I got denied by my next insurance company by four of them. Four of them denied me because they saw that keyword insurance mm-hmm. during their underwriting cancer during mm-hmm. the underwriting process. And so I went back to my doctor and I said, don't put that in there. That doesn't apply to me. That applies to my brother. And he said, well, I can't take it out by law. I cannot take that out. Oh, you can't just leave it there because all these insurers see that word and they just throw my application away.
And for that reason, whenever we do go to get a checkup, we're very careful and hesitant about what we say to our doctor, because anything we say gets written down and it could be grounds to not get insurance the next time. Now, while we're on preventative care, because Jim should be screened, we have some hesitancies about that, too.
Yeah. Let me address that.
Go ahead.
As I said, my brother's had this cancer, and I should, in all diligence, go in and have myself tested. And I can afford to see a doctor. I'm going to pay cash. But I can't afford the MRIs, the CT scans, the blood work, all the lab tests necessary to actually do a full diagnosis. Well, let's say I could afford that, okay? $7,500 premium, okay. Maybe I'll use up the whole deductible, a $7,500 deductible. What would happen then is, let's say I'm lucky, they come back, no cancer. Well, they're going to find something. They always do. They'll find little this, little that, and it'll all go in my medical record. Now, next time I go to apply for insurance, they're going to have that right in front of the underwriter, and he's going to look through, and we're going to exclude this, and we're going to exclude this, we're going to exclude this. And it's like, it's a no-win scenario. I can't go in because I can't afford it, and I can't go in because I can't afford to have what they would write in my medical record.
Let's welcome phone calls. Oh, my gosh.
There is more to come.
800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. All of our lines are busy right now, and we're going to introduce another guest as well, Professor Debbie Sokolar, Project Manager of Health Policy and Management at the Boston University School of Public Health. What's the answer to all of this is the question as we continue. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining our conversation now is another guest, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls for everybody in a moment. Debbie Sokolar is with us now. Debbie is a director of the Health Reform Program at the Boston University School of Public Health. She has done a great deal of work analyzing healthcare costs and access problems in Massachusetts and nationally for some 20 years, starting with the implementation of the 1988 Dukakis-era Massachusetts Universal Healthcare Law, which was repealed in the early 90s. They've seen overwhelming evidence that the United States healthcare spending is enough to take care of everybody in this country and take care of them very nicely, twice the per person spending of other wealthy nations, with about half of it wasted. There are healthcare reform forums coming up, and we will give you information about those in case you would like to go to one of those forums in the coming weeks. And Debbie, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I have to be there.
You heard Jim and Jan's story here, I think. It makes you want to throw up your hands, and I know they're not alone. If you're buying health care coverage, you ought to be able to get health care coverage, right? What a system.
It's such a revealing story. It reveals so much about the failures of private health insurance, the failures of job-based health insurance, the failures of, in recent years, the received wisdom has been that the way to contain costs is to introduce these high-deductible health policies or plans where patients have to be more sensitive to costs and have higher cost sharing, so-called, and that's how to contain costs. But their situation is one of many in which it's clear that if you have a skimpy health insurance plan, then they said, you can be insured but have no access to care. I think, in fact, the vast majority of Americans are underinsured. Another way of saying that, very few people have good coverage for mental health care, long-term care, and dental care, just starting with those particular areas of service that you never know when you might need, even apart from whether you have high deductibles and so on. So I think any health reform that's really going to do the job has to meet the needs of people who are underinsured as well as filling the gap for people who are currently uninsured.
Debbie, we've been, this is facing so many people, as you talk about the fact that so many dollars are wasted in the healthcare system. So many people are in a situation, as Jim and Jan are, and some in worse situations with no healthcare whatsoever. What in the world? Because it affects all of us, businesses and Democrats and Republicans and independents, everybody. What keeps us from moving forward on changing this system?
Well, I think it is very important to think about what has blocked reform going back 75 years. Certainly, there was the long-time worry that doctors raised, the American Medical Association for decades raised the bogeyman of socialized medicine. If government gets involved, it's going to be like socialism. And amazingly, over the last couple of weeks, we're starting to hear some members of Congress raising that sort of almost red-baiting of healthcare reform that takes seriously the need for a government role to provide health security. I think every other country, developed, wealthy country in the world that covers everybody, does it for less money than we do, they all recognize that to do that and contain costs, you have to have a significant government role. But whether it's from ideological stubbornness, or whether it's in part because for a long time members of Congress have been receiving big campaign contributions from the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and others with a vested interest in the status quo, there's been a lot of resistance. And I think the other reality is that this is a diverse country with states with different needs. So it is tricky to design a plan that works to address the needs of every state, given that we've had such a decentralized situation, and now some states have very skimpy Medicaid plans, some states have more generous ones, rural states have different needs in terms of provider networks, and so on and so on. So there's a variety of things, but I think the biggest force that we are likely to come up against is this continued scare tactic that any kind of serious reform is going to be government getting in between you and your doctor. Well, frankly, many people, I think, would rather have an accountable government program shaping policy than Wall Street. I mean, look where Wall Street has gotten us in terms of the current economy, and that's what drives, short-term profit decisions drive the policy making of many of the nation's health insurance companies. Not all of them are for-profit, but would you rather have Wall Street in between you and your and your doctor, or the policy making of elected government representatives who seem to have managed to make Medicare into a pretty good program that Americans trust?
There isn't much unhappiness with that. The other thing that was striking to me when I was listening to you, Jim and Jan, is that trying to figure out your health care has consumed an enormous amount of your time as well. We need something that's not as incredibly complicated as what you've had to go through. We need to simplify this system somehow. Well, am I wrong?
No, and one thing we really need is transparency in the system. And what I mean by that is the reason it's not operating with free market economy principles is because you can't find out what something is going to cost you. I also have a history of cancer in my family, colon cancer, and so a few years ago my doctor recommended I have a colonoscopy. Now, we started calling around to find out what this would cost, and no one could tell us. Not only could no one tell us what it would cost, they couldn't even tell us how many different bills we were going to get from radiologists and different facilities. We finally just threw up our hands, and it did just take an inordinate amount of time. We threw up our hands and said, we're just going to do it. The final bill was $3,300, which came out of our pocket. We have since shown that bill to our son-in-law, who's a doctor, and a couple other physicians we know, and they say that's an outrageous fee for that procedure, but we couldn't find out because there's no transparency. You cannot find out what something's going to cost you and then go shop somewhere else to see if you can get a little bit of a reduced cost.
Let's take some phone calls. We've had all four lines going for a long time, so let's go to the audience as well. 800-486-8655. Judy from Ripon is our first caller. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am so thankful that you have guests on that get the nail on the head. I'm a registered nurse. My husband is a family practitioner. If Barack Obama wants to know what is wrong with our healthcare system, he needs to have nurses and doctors that are on the front lines. I can tell you very simply, and I'll keep it brief because I know there's a lot of callers, exactly what's wrong with our healthcare system. The insurance companies have got to go. They are the ones that are making these profits. They have totally taken competition out of the equation because they sell an insurance policy to your employer. It doesn't matter if you run from hospital to hospital to see what your bill for your colonoscopy is going to cost, because it doesn't matter. You don't get to choose what hospital you're going to go to. You have to go to the one that your insurance company provides for. They've taken competition out of the equation. They've sold them a policy, and they'll say, we'll give you X number of patients, or we'll sell you an insurance policy for your employees, and it'll cost you this much. But what they don't tell you is, we're going to pay the doctor, we're going to squeeze the primary care physicians at the bottom. I'm talking about family practice. I do not know about specialists. We're going to squeeze the hospitals and the doctors at the bottom. We're going to scrape off an incredible amount of money off the top and keep it for ourselves. And then they go back to the doctors and say, well, we'll deliver this industry to you if you sign on with us. I mean, it's a shell game. It's got to go. It's got to be single-payer system, number one. Number two, the end-of-life care in intensive care units. I'm an intensive care unit nurse. I see people that are 89 years old that have everything thrown at them because families want to throw in every last-ditch effort on grandma at the very last minute, mm-hmm. without being realistic. And we try to talk to people. We say, look, you know, she's 89 years old. It's going to be painful procedures. They're not going to bring her back, but they want it. They want it all. And that attitude has to change in this country, that we cannot be throwing every last-ditch effort at these people in the last 24 hours of their lives, which can cost up to $70,000 in one day. And then my last and final comment about the first guests that you had on, thank God that they're on that committee, because they were saying that they had been denied by all these insurance companies. I want to know how many of those insurance companies, after taking all of their money and then denied them, gave their money back. They took no risk. That insurance, absolutely no risk. They took all of their money and then denied them. And they saw none of that money back. And that's my comments, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you, Judy. People feel strongly about this issue.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I'll mention one thing pertinent to that. There was a law enacted back in 1974 called ERISA. And
right.
What that had the effect of doing is taking state control of health care or health insurance to the federal level. And prior to 1974, if somebody went in for claims were denied, they could sue the insurance company and say, and they could get damages, essentially. Because you denied this claim, we're going to get you to pay the claim, and we're going to sue you in court for damages. Well, after 1974, the sue you in court for damages was erased. So now the maximum liability that an insurance company holds for denying a claim is the amount of the claim. So if the worst thing that can happen is that you'll have to pay the claim that you're supposed to pay anyway, where's your incentive not to deny the claim?
And that's where the policies come of just denying across the board the first time on many things and then seeing if anybody complains or if people just go with it. Because, again, as Jim said, if you get sued, all that's going to happen is you got to pay what you should have paid.
Yeah, right. Debbie, let's spend a few moments before we go back to phone calls on the huge number, millions, 46, 47 million people in this country who have no insurance whatsoever. Who's addressing that? Do you expect there will be some kind of plan for those who are uninsured fairly soon? And why do we allow that in this country?
Well, I think, unfortunately, we've allowed it in part because it's not a politically powerful constituency. And also because most people actually are fairly healthy most of the time. And then when you're sick, you're busy trying to survive, trying to get health care, and not in a position to be you know, lobbying hard in many cases, though thankfully there are some vocal advocates. I do think that clearly a major focus of the current debate about healthcare reform is trying to ensure the uninsured, and, you know, whether we succeed this time, I don't know. I think we'll have to, you know, there was clearly a lot of determination expressed at that summit, and in the president in his recent speech to Congress and in his budget proposal. There's a number of good steps on that path. I think, as I said earlier, it is really important to not just focus on the uninsured, but also address the needs of the underinsured. In some respects, the recently adopted Massachusetts healthcare reform law is one that adopts coverage that may be too skimpy for people to be able to access the care they need in many cases, and requiring people to buy a commercial health insurance product that is affordable to them only because it's a skimpy plan is not going to be a solution to getting people access to care. In terms of, you know, whether we are going to do something about it, I think there's a small window for action before Congress winds up turning its attention to other issues and to the elections for 2010. But one really important thing to think about is that the economic crunch we're in, this near depression heading downwards, should not be used as an excuse to say, oh, we can't afford this now. And in fact, even though my colleague Professor Alan Sager and I in our health reform program have for many years been highlighting the need to squeeze out and recycle lots of the money that's wasted in healthcare, the need to and the feasibility of squeezing out wasted sums and using that to expand coverage, right now may be a time when we should just, as a nation, expand coverage. There was, thankfully, some expansion of coverage for children enacted earlier this year,
the SCHIP
plan expansion. But the economy right now needs that stimulus. Business spending has dried up. Consumers' ability to spend has dried up. And it's only government spending. If you think of those as three streams that fill a lake, if we follow the recommendations of some on one side of the aisle in Congress these days, there's a lot of talk about clamping down on government spending. This is exactly the wrong time to do that, or the whole economy will dry up. So this may be the moment when it could make sense to cover people, cover everyone now, and we certainly can do it with close to current levels of spending and cover people well, as you mentioned earlier. Lots of evidence of that. But we need to pay attention to cost control, certainly for future years, but there will be startup costs, and focusing in on cost control right now may not be the key thing in the current state of the economy.
More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. We're talking about health care reform this hour of our program. Jim and Jan Stopher with Holy Cow Frozen Custard in Delafield are with us. Jim, as a result of their families dealing with the health care morass over the past so many years and trying to get insurance and complete insurance for their family, he wrote a letter that got to the hands of people close to the President of the United States and to the President of the United States as well about what they had been through. And he was invited to the healthcare summit to participate in the summit last week, March 5th, at the White House. Debbie Sokolar is also joining us, Director of the Health Reform Program at the Boston University School of Public Health. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls now. Stan from Altoona. Hi, Stan.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just give you a quick background. I have sold health insurance. Your guests are absolutely right. And currently, I'm on Medicare, but don't try to go to the Mayo Clinic with Medicare because it isn't going to work.
Why is that?
They won't take you as a patient. That's what I was told at Luther Middleford.
Really?
Yes, and they are part of that system.
Hmm.
The other, but my main point is the reason the American healthcare system is broken is there's so many vested interests in keeping it the way it is. It's very profitable the way it is, for the insurance companies and the doctors and so forth. Other systems, Japanese, other countries, they have lower costs. They use natural products that do the same thing. I took a product to a red algae to a dermatologist. It works 75% of the time in eliminating cold sores within hours. No interest. Simply no interest. I think the solution here is if we just focus on getting costs down, it isn't going to work. It's the system itself, the treatment. People are healthcare illiterate. Americans have to be educated and held accountable for their own health care. I'm not saying they have to do everything themselves, but they have to know what's going on. They don't know what's going on. Their doctors have taught them not to know what's going on.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Stan. And what about other systems? As we try to come up with something different, are there lessons we can learn from Japan, from Canada, from Germany, wherever?
Well, you have to be careful bringing that up in this environment because most people will point to everyone else as a terrible way.
Right.
But in reality, if you look around the world, you don't see a lot of other developed nations trying to emulate our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the World Health Organization rates the United States coverage 37th in the world, just below the Dominican Republic.
Oh my gosh.
So we're not exactly at the top of the heap here, even though there's been a great deal of effort on the part of vested interests to make us think we have this premium system so that people are afraid of a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody will say, well, we have the best healthcare in the world, and maybe we do. We do have probably the best healthcare facilities in the world and maybe the best doctors, but the system is broken.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Stan. We go to Art from Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And your guests, I think, hit it right on the head in terms of explaining how the system works. I've had very similar experiences with, the insurance companies, for an individual policy, they raise the rates fantastically, so they can force people into being re-underwritten, and then they exclude everybody who's got anything wrong with them. And there's no incentive to do any preventive discussion with your doctor because they'll write a note and then they'll use that to exclude any possible coverage. So, but my concern is Democracy Now! Today had almost the whole hour on the exclusion of advocates for single health plan, single payer plan, from the summit and from the discussion. And Obama has made the political judgment, even though in the past he's said that single payer was the logical way to save money, that it's politically not going to work. And so they're attempting, there was a big campaign to get John Conyers, who's one of the sponsors of single payer legislation, invited to the summit, and finally he and I think the head of the New England Journal of Medicine, who did a study on this, were allowed in. But like Quentin Young was on, he's a very good friend of Barack and was the doctor for Martin Luther King. And he was one of the people that was excluded, et cetera. So there's an attempt for expediency or because of all the, probably billions of dollars being made by these insurance companies and then spreading that to the lobbyists to cut that discussion out of the debate.
Did you feel that was the case when you went to the White House summit?
Single-payer
system. Is it being considered?
It is being considered. I think President Obama is being very careful to adjust my mic here. He's being very careful to make sure that people that are happy with their existing health plan don't have an excuse to say, well, I don't want to lose what I already have. So he's trying to structure something where people can either keep their existing health plan or they will have this more nationalized system in the background that will take up the overspill of all those people that don't have something they're happy with. Now, whether that's something that will actually work or not, I don't know. I mean, once something else is available, will that impact the current system the way it is? There's a lot of unknowns, but I think the president is trying to approach this more from, you guys come up with a solution, tell us what we need to do, and then we will make the decision. But we're not going to impose this on the country without first hearing all sides.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tendency for people to think that it's a very black and white. It's either socialized medicine or the system we have. There are lots of other options. There are a number of countries that have combinations of a private system and a universal type healthcare system. And there are any number of variations on this. So we've got a lot of options.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think we're going to be going with all of this, Debbie, in the next year? Is there a sense of urgency? Do you think that this president wants to move on a lot of fronts fairly quickly? What are your hopes?
Well, I am hopeful that there's a sense of urgency. I also do fear that the window could close. So I think it is very important, probably right now, in fact, for people who are concerned to see action on this front to contact their members of Congress and let them know that they want action on health care coverage for all this year, and they want good comprehensive coverage that people can actually afford to use, and so on. One of the key first vehicles that will shape how the debate unfolds is the budget resolutions that key congressional committees are developing right now, which structure the debate over the budget. Mm-hmm. And the president's budget, in fact, included what he called a down payment on health care reform. I think that this could wind up going in any of many, many directions. I think it's very important for people who support a variety of different solutions but recognize have some shared opinions about the problems, whether people are single-payer advocates or advocates of more mixed models. As Jan said, there are many models in other countries in which nonprofit, multiple nonprofit insurance plans play a role, that people need to focus on the problems and not get into disputing, attacking each other within the circle of advocates for real patient-oriented, citizen-oriented reform. That could be a danger. And I guess I'd throw out one other thing, which is that it's also important for those who've been working over recent years when national reform seemed to be off the table. It's also important for folks to continue the work they've been doing at the state level for state expansion, state new models of insurance regulation at the state level, and so on. I know in Wisconsin there was some quite creative discussion a couple of years ago of something I believe was called Healthy Wisconsin that could set a model for state-based plans. And if, sad to say, if somehow national reform is blocked, there are fallback models for legislation in Congress that your representative Tammy Baldwin has been one of the leaders of supporting legislation to permit states mm-hmm. to experiment with different approaches to achieve universal coverage. Mm-hmm. So down the line, it might turn out that things stymie a single model of a national plan, and we need to turn to state-focused reforms. I certainly hope not. But even in the meantime, the state-focused actions are creating examples of policies that members of Congress could consider incorporating in national reform, like limiting the if people are going to be using commercial insurance, limiting the percentage of that that can be devoted to marketing and profit and administration as opposed to actual care.
Mm-hmm. We do want to remind you, tell you maybe for the first time, that a series of the summit conversations will be taking place at the University of Wisconsin School of Law. And this is taking place on April 7, hosted by former Governor Tommy Thompson. And there will be a link to all of this at our website, WPR.org. So those of you who are interested in attending will be able to do so. We have about 30 seconds left. Are you more hopeful after going to the White House that something's afoot?
Yep. And one thing I would close with, people that are content with their group employer health insurance need to remember that at age 55, age 60, somewhere in there, they may, for several reasons, lose that employment. They may decide they want to retire early. They may get laid off. The individual health policy could be in your back pocket. And just remember, everything that you're saying to your doctor today is going into your medical record, and it may come back to haunt you if they don't change this system.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
For coming in. Our guests, Jim and Jan Stouffer from Holy Cow Frozen Custard in Delafield, Wisconsin. And we also thank Debbie Sokolar for being with us. Debbie is a director of the Health Reform Program at the Boston University School of Public Health. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour. And thanks to Rob as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. If you go to our website, there will be more information about the upcoming continuing summit on healthcare reform, the one taking place in Wisconsin in Madison on April 7. Our address is WPR.org. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then I'll return with another hour of Wednesday conversation. We'll be looking at a number of issues with Tom Hayden, who's a social and political activist, longtime California state senator, founder of the Port Huron Statement, the vision call of the 1960s revolution. That'll be coming up in a moment.